access to ranking, making payments and saving, so more fees are taken. And every day the gatekeepers are trying to stop change. We cannot wait. Welcome to the blockchain.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Henry Rang Show here on WWPR 1490 AM. Heard every Monday, 5.05 p.m. to 6 p.m. Immediately after Talking Markets with Mark, Andrew, and now David. And that's your weekly roundup of Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and blockchain news coming up now and more. Well, what happened this week? Financial services giant Fidelity Investment goes live with its cryptocurrency custody service. And what does the block reward halving, well, what is the block reward halving, and what does it have to do with Bitcoin's price? Also, Jack Dorsey, CEO of both Twitter and Square, says he's buying $10,000 of Bitcoin a week. And sorry, Charlie, but Bumblebee Foods has launched a blockchain platform for seafood traceability. Well, we've got a full house today for a change of pace to help us go through all of this. And let's see who's here today. Well, you were just listening to him on the preceding show, and he's sticking around to help us out for a little while today. And that, of course, is the Andrew from Talking Markets with Mark and Andrew, but we know him as Andy. Hey, Andy.
Good afternoon, Henry. Glad I could be here.
Yes, and it's good because you cover so much ground in that Talking Markets show that Bitcoin is just one facet of it. You've got Forex, metals, stocks, options, and donuts.
Donuts. I mean, that's the key of the week.
And we also have here in the studio, back for the first time in a few weeks, it's our resident blockchain developer, Stephen Luca. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Henry. Happy to be back.
Yeah, good make it. Hope the traffic wasn't too bad coming all the way up from Sarasota. I'm temporarily fighting that myself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's always an adventure on US 41 here in this area.
So you say that all it proves that I'm insane. You made it right, I made it crazy. But it just made me a lunatic you're looking for.
Well, he always says once is not enough, so he's doing it twice in a row now, and that's Augie. Hey, Augie, good to see you.
Hey, Henry, it's I listened to Andy's show, and I'm curious about what he has to say about gold. It dropped pretty heavily today.
Well, we can make an exception and go ahead and start with gold.
I like gold. I think I like gold in the 1270. I think we originally had a 1265 target. We've moved that up to 1275. I like the 1275 for a reversal.
No, where is gold today on prices?
Oh, it's 1280s.
It was a little lower than that, but that's okay.
Yeah. So it gets down in the 1275 area. That's where I'm a buyer, and that's where we'll be looking to go along with gold.
Well, it's bumped up. It was up at 13 plus, and now it's going back down.
We expected a pullback. You just never know when it's going to happen.
Strong
it had extended
dollar.
Top, and
strong
but
dollar.
You need to subscribe to SeekingCryptos.com, and then you could follow all this stuff right there.
Absolutely.
On the website.
Post
you
gold
you
every
have
week.
To wait till Monday to find out.
Gold. I still like silver here. Silver's the undervalued commodity. If you want to buy something, buy silver.
Well, let's go to who we haven't had a chance to talk to in a few weeks. Stephen, you're here. What? Any new projects you're working on, or what's going on?
Nothing too new or cutting, but just watching watching everything that's going on in the market, and I think we'll talk about Fidelity here in a minute. That's been that definitely caught my eye lately.
Right.
I got to ask Stephen what the hell is halving? Is that like
we're
halving?
We're gonna find out. It's in the rundown, man.
In the rundown.
We're gonna find out.
We're gonna talk all about halving.
Well, yeah, we start with the biggest story and work our way through this list here that's on the screen.
I just saw that Stephen kind of lit up on that. That's why I asked.
I think he lit up on that.
Well, there you go.
I don't know why having strikes your fancy, but we will get to that in just a second. I guess we ought to get to the news.
I tell you, I've got news for you.
Well, our lead story is that Fidelity Digital Assets, a new company created by the investing giant Fidelity Investments, has quietly rolled out its cryptocurrency custody and trade execution operations. In the past few months, it has been up and running with institutional investors like hedge funds and family offices, according to its top executive. The collapse in cryptocurrency prices over the last year, quote, haven't had an impact on getting up and running, Tom Jessup, head of Fidelity Digital Assets, said at the D.C. Blockchain Summit to CNBC last year. If you started a crypto fund at the height of the market, you're probably hurting right now. Well, very astute, Mr. Jessup, on that one. Still, he said there's long-term interest from institutional investors to add forms of cryptocurrency to their portfolios, and it's often seen as an uncorrelated risk or a store value in crisis. The firm said that the interest is still high despite the price activity. They interviewed roughly 450 institutions, wealthy families to hedge funds to pensions and endowments. About 22% of the respondents already own cryptocurrency, so that would say about 100 of the institutions then. They own it and expect to double their allocation over the next 5 years, quoting Mr. Jessup again. If anything, they are as encouraged now as they were when prices were higher. The new company will execute trades on multiple exchanges for these professional investors. There's a little bit more information here. We're going to unpack this in just a second. It also handles custody or the safe storage of digital assets. Until Fidelity, there had been a noticeable lack of a big U.S.-based company in that business, and they're going to expand as their jurisdictional coverage allows them to. In other words, if there's any states like New York where they may be or may not be able to do it. They actually rolled it out so customers could use it in January, while for some they started this month, and the people they're keeping a distance from won't get the chance to do it till September. And so let's back this up and talk about it here. So, Andy, you're here practically every week. And I think we must have talked about this 7, 8, 9 months ago, maybe. Fidelity, for people that don't know, prior to the big running in Bitcoin, they had a relationship with Coinbase so that their clients could monitor their Coinbase balances from the Fidelity account. Fidelity didn't handle any of the trades or anything like that. Excuse me. But you have to think that was a good way for them to gather information. Much like Google or Facebook looking over your shoulder, they know what their clients are doing. But to actually launch this subsidiary, to take custody of Bitcoin, and now they're executing trades on multiple exchanges, what does that tell you about their prep and what they see?
Well, I mean, I think it tells you for the whole space what you're seeing is larger investors, larger institutions. We start hearing pension plans and trust. You know, large trusts like Harvard and them getting into the space. These people don't care about the price going down 300 or 400 points. So as they start to accumulate, they're taking inventory and what is actively traded out of the market. And what that will eventually do is it's going to put a squeeze on the market. There's only so many shares out there. We saw that with Tilray. If you remember, there were only so many actively traded. Yes. And so when the float starts to dwindle down to where the active participants, there's just not a lot out. In order for more to come into the market, the price has to go up. It's just simple price and demand. So as these institutions and that start to get, and these people that are buying it, you know, like the Jack Dorsey you mentioned, and those people, they're not trading this stuff. They're not looking for a $300 or $400 move. They're long term, 5, 10 years out. That's what they're looking to hold it for, just like they do with gold. When they buy gold, they put it in J.P. Morgan's safe, and it sits there for years. They don't care. It's just safe haven investment, and that's how they're looking at Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And I don't know what other ones they're buying, but it seems
The established institutions are telling them they're going to double their holdings, and you have more that are telling them they're going to come into the space.
And more that's coming out.
I know this story caught your attention too, Stephen. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, to me, this is just the, I just want to go over, this is just the latest from Fidelity. To note today, Fidelity has been mining Bitcoin since 2015. They've been accepting Bitcoin donations for a number of years. They have a VC.
Wait. So let's slow down now. Now, Mr. Jessup here, he didn't have any quotes about them Bitcoin mining. When did they start Bitcoin?
Fidelity, so not Fidelity Digital Assets. Fidelity Digital Assets is a company that, you know, was recently founded by Fidelity, but Fidelity itself,
Fidelity Investments,
has been mining Bitcoin since 2015. Not for profit, not to make money, but to learn about, they're not a Bitmain. They're not putting out 20% the hash power, but they've run nodes, they've run mining operations, and they've done this to learn about cryptocurrencies.
Since 2015. Did you know this, Andy?
So apparently they liked what they found out, and so they've also done donations. Like you said, they integrated with Coinbase to have wallet access on their VC arm. They have funded multiple blockchain startups, as well as one called Symbiont, where they are integrating their technology, the blockchain technology, into their software offering from a software arm. So this is for digital securities. So Fidelity, this is the latest thing. This is cryptocurrency. This is Bitcoin custody and clearing. This is the latest thing that they've come to offer. So really, Fidelity has been, I really think they are the industry leader if we're talking about major U.S. major corporations. Not startups and such, but they've done more than anybody else. And I think it's interesting that, this has been in operation actually for months, and we're only now just finding out about it.
I'm going to get to you in a second, but I want to go back to Andy for one thing here. The fact that they can execute trades on multiple exchanges, like if you're on TD Ameritrade or some of the others and you ask for smart routing, and they're possibly doing it on the same market you see on your CNBC screen, but they might be going somewhere else. Does that say something about a level of expertise to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, that happened when in the late 90s when the stock market went through the whole ECN thing where you had the electronic central networks that took orders from various exchanges and then gave you the best price. And I think that really needs to happen so that we can get some more stability in the space. That way you don't have one person on an exchange creates just the robos going in. That's what creates the volatility. So once you get a centralized exchange, you're going to see a lot more stability in it. And if Fidelity is leading that way, I mean, that's a huge – I mean, I don't think people understand. That's really big for this market. That's really big for this market.
All right. Augie?
Oh, sounds like regulation to me. I mean, stability, regulation, trust, all those things are what's implied in what Andy just said. So the libertarians have to be tearing their hair out at this conversation.
Well, I don't think it has anything to do with regulations. Oh, I think is what it has to do with is if you have a centralized exchange that's pulling in the best orders from different exchanges and saying, and I go, I'm on Coinbase and I go to buy, I'm getting the best price and it's going to transfer that to my account regardless of where it is.
Well, the immediate, I think, to what you say and then to what Augie says, to what you say, the immediate effect is the marketplace. And its effect on that. But one of the things that you speak of with the regulation is one of the things the SEC has consistently said. They needed a more trusted and secure way of custody of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. They wanted to be able to collect information from multiple exchanges and marketplaces, which Fidelity evidently is doing. And they wanted someone they could put their confidence in.
Trust.
Well, the problem with the SEC, and not to get overblown and sidetracked because Stephen's here, the SEC should be enforcing laws, not creating them. And that's one issue that we've had with over the last 50 or so years is you have the executive branch appoints people to the SEC or the FDA, and then they create the laws. And that was never the intent. The law should be created in Congress, and all they should be there is to enforce the laws. And we would be so much further ahead if the SEC wasn't jerking around with, how are we going to they don't need to regulate it. All they need to do is give their stamp of approval. Let the market is the best.
You've listened to the hearings in Congress. You really believe that the legislators have the
But
expertise?
There's no law against it. There's no law against it. And I don't think they could come out with a law against it. So there's really nothing here that says there's no reason
they
can't do it.
We're talking about the approval of the exchange.
ETF.
So
that's what I'm saying.
It's already part of their mandate that they approve different investments.
Yeah, I mean, you're trading ETFs in oil. You're trading ETFs. And oil is probably the most
unstable there is.
Well, it's the most manipulated market there
that's
is because
right.
you have OPEC that manipulates it.
Exactly.
So if you have not only this OPEC, it's a group of countries, the biggest oil producers, they manipulate. If they want to turn off and make the price go up, they can do that. So to say, but there's an oil ETF, nobody can manipulate the price of Bitcoin. It's very difficult to do because there's too much popularity of it. Now, again, the market is a perfect discounting mechanism. It's just like gold. And I've seen this many times in with the gold market, where during periods of low volume, like on a holiday when the U.S. is closed, somebody may search for stops, and they go and they push through the stops, and they have an oil. Now, if you want to call that manipulation, so be it. That's the same thing they do with Bitcoin. They search for stops.
Yeah.
And that's not manipulation.
That's not manipulation.
That's just somebody at the table having a bigger stack than you and pushing you around. And you just have to be aware of it. If you're not aware of that, you shouldn't be in the game.
So pumping and dumping is okay.
That happens in every market.
Absolutely.
I mean, any a big player in any market at the right time can fully
because the in the markets that we normally see traded, over-the-counter trades have to be reported within a certain time frame. And there's no reporting on these over-the-counter markets in Bitcoin.
Well, we talk about the gold market is the most manipulated, one of the most manipulated, because you have a group of bankers that sit around London, and at 9 a.m. they release the golden spot. It has nothing to do with the open market. It's a bunch of bankers going around and go, okay, 1250 is the spot today. And we've seen it where they've actually lowered the spot on silver, where they've actually, and JPM, and a lot of them are in trouble now. But they made so much money, those fines are negligible. So we've actually had a system there that lets the large banks in that manipulate the market, and the SEC is pretty much the enforcer, allowing them to do it.
We'll wrap up this, but you can get a last comment in if you want, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only reason they're not approving these Bitcoin ETFs is because it's Bitcoin. Not, the concerns they have are just, they're happening in other markets, and it's no reason not to approve it. It's just because they don't want to take that step. They don't want to fully endorse something that is Bitcoin related yet, and it's political. It's not market based.
Goldman Sachs definitely doesn't want the Fidelity to be the first one or the brothers. And how many Goldman Sachs are on the SEC? There's two of them. And also the CBOE, he's from Goldman Sachs. So there's so many Goldman Sachs, and if two Goldman Sachs comes out with an ETF, you're not going to get an ETF.
And you have that one SEC commissioner, I think Helena
Pierce.
Well,
you have now two because the new one has expressed favorable comments.
Okay, but the
original
one.
And even the Obama holdover is now starting to...
Yeah, but Pierce, I mean, it's pretty much said all of these things.
Okay. So we're going to go to a break, and we'll come back with the Bitcoin halving and what that means for all of us. You're listening to The Henry Raine Show. Come back to the news. We mentioned this at the start of the segment. Alistair Mine, the chief investment officer at Atlanta Digital Currency Fund. I guess my mind was on mining. It's actually Alistair Milne speaking of buzzes. Block reward halving in Bitcoin is going to be a fundamental driver of Bitcoin price, according to Mr. Milne. The block reward halving in Bitcoin is referred to as the mechanism that decreases the amount of Bitcoin generated by miners after mining a block. The block reward of the Bitcoin network is expected to decrease by half in 15 months, which is an especially long time frame for this show to be talking about, since we barely can talk about what's going to happen next hour. Traditionally, a block reward halving has led the price of Bitcoin rally because it reduces the rate at which new Bitcoin is produced. Well, we're getting close to the point of where the 21 million Bitcoins will have been mined and produced, but the miners will still be getting a transaction reward, I believe, for completing these. So we're going to go to our blockchain developer, Stephen Lubka, to say, so 15 months this is going to take to happen. Is it a gradual thing, or
no.
Just the switch
flips?
So what happens here is, so to understand, with Bitcoin mining, there is a block reward which goes to the miner or mining pool, which successfully publishes, you know, each block. So there's a block every 10 minutes, and the current mining reward is 12 Bitcoin. Now, this also includes the transaction fee separate from the 12 Bitcoin.
Let's slow down and break it down. So the company that mines it, completes the transaction first, is the one that gets the reward.
Yes.
But because it's a distributed ledger, it's showing up on everybody else's mine?
Yep. You got it. Yeah.
All right.
So whichever miner publishes the block, and you know that means to the whole network, and it's accepted by the whole network, gets a mining reward of 12 Bitcoin. When the Bitcoin so the way the reward scheme in Bitcoin is set up is that the amount of Bitcoin that is issued as a reward, it decreases by half at certain intervals, and this continues until it, you know, obviously nothing, it never reaches. You know, mathematically, it would never reach zero, but at a certain point, it just hits zero.
Effectively zero.
But literally zero. They cheat. So at the very end of it, they just flip it to zero. So what's going to happen is on May 2020, it's going to flip from 12 Bitcoin per block to 6 Bitcoin per block. And now this can be a price driver. This is a price driver on a fundamental level for two reasons. The first is just that even though we know there's a certain amount of Bitcoin, there won't be any more, the relative inflation rate, the amount of new Bitcoins being issued, cuts in half. So half as many new Bitcoins are being created. The more important reason is that the miners get less Bitcoins, which means they have less Bitcoins to sell. Miner selling is one of the primary selling forces in the Bitcoin market, because if you're mining Bitcoin, you know, you're paying power, you're paying all these costs. You can't just sit on the Bitcoin. You need to turn it into cash. And, you know, a lot of times people, you know, not just to cover their expenses, but to realize profits, and, you know, also it can be a strategy. So miners currently, you know, think about this. Every 10 minutes, there are 12 Bitcoin that go to a miner, and those will be sold. So that's, you know.
You know, I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but I'm taking us there a little bit. So let's call it the alpha miner, the one that gets to the block.
Sure.
And all that transaction goes on at all the other miners that don't get any reward.
Yes.
Does it take up as much resources, electricity, and time?
Yes, for everybody, regardless of whether they win.
So there's probably thousands, literally thousands of miners that get nothing for doing the work.
But think about, you know, 12 Bitcoin, that's quite a chunk of change for a 10-minute block. So you don't need to, you know, if you just get
not
one.
Not all miners are created equal, right?
Yes, precisely. And most of the little miners band together in pools and split the money. And that's how, you know, to go down that road, if you have a bunch of weak miners that would never win it on their own, they all group together and split the reward whenever anyone gets it. And so that's kind of the approach there.
So but 12... Bitcoin
every 10 minutes
is about $40,000, maybe a little more.
So think about it, that's $40,000 of selling pressure every 10 minutes. So that's substantial. Now, that's going to drop to 6 Bitcoin. And so one, it's going to reduce the selling pressure. Two, it's going to reduce the inflation. But there's a hidden caveat here, and that the value of whereas 12 Bitcoin, a 12 Bitcoin block reward needed to be enough to cover mining operations, meaning it has to be more than the power cost and operations, and that reward has to be substantial enough that it makes sense for miners to mine Bitcoin, or the network, you know, can't work. That means when it cuts to 6, now 6 Bitcoin need to be enough to cover mining operations. And if, might say, the cost of mining operations doesn't change, then the value of Bitcoin should increase to ensure that miners can keep mining.
But if they can't keep mining,
if the market doesn't support the price,
well, that's, it has to if it wants to continue. That's the thing.
So we're reaching a point of no return.
Well, this has happened several times, and we've seen that this has been a driver, because, you know, that price But it's those other factors too. It's not just that the market has to now magically accommodate the price, the new price, but it's also that the miners stop selling. So it's like you take off this pressure, and it allows the price to go up. The thing is the miners won't sell it below that price. So let's just say if it was just to happen right now, you know, say we're operating at 4,000, the miners need 4,000, and if it were to half tomorrow, you know, if the miners need 4,000, they'll sell at 4,000. That's their point that they can sell. But if suddenly it cuts in half and now they need 8,000, they're going to stop selling until the price reaches 8,000. And they will also be very hesitant to sell it below that price. So that
unless they're desperate.
Unless they're desperate. Obviously this isn't a hard and fast rule, but the incentive, you know, I want it to be close to that price. So the price I need to sell as a miner doubles when halving happens. And so your biggest sellers let up. And they're very highly incentivized to not take the price below that level, which is double now. And so that's why the halving...
Why are they incentivized?
Because they won't be able to... They'll stop being profitable.
Or
they won't be able to operate.
They're disincentivized to take a lower price.
Yeah,
I know,
sure.
But then if the desperation reaches a point of what?
Sure, but you can only exist at that level of desperation for so much time. So it's not sustainable. They can't.
So it also would drive greater consolidation, it sounds like.
In, you know, who the profitable miners are?
Yes.
Yes, that could happen too. It could definitely weed out the weaker miners. But either way, you know, it creates a situation that highly favors the price of Bitcoin reaching a new, is going up to accommodate a reduction in the block reward.
Okay. So we've got in the show prep, there's a graph from Chainalysis.com that says 29% of the potential Bitcoin universe is either lost or unmined. But the unmined part is relatively small.
Yeah.
So, which means...
Let me touch on
pretty
that
high percent
quick,
of lost.
Because that's the last part right there. You talk about unmined, and just to revisit what we were talking about, as the halvings get on, so it's going to turn to 6. The next time it'll turn to 3, the next time 1.5, then 0.75. It gets us closer and closer to the point that 99% of all Bitcoins which will ever exist do exist. And so this is saying 29% lost or unmined. As this time goes on and we reach halving and halving, the other reason it drives the price up is because the amount of new Bitcoin effectively reaches zero. And so that's the other reason that this drives price.
So when can you decide on the total Bitcoin that's remaining?
What do you mean?
Well, if does it all disappear?
It's a known number.
It's a known number,
just,
yeah. 21
here
million.
In the studio don't know the number that's been mined off
sure.
the top of our
yeah.
head.
Yeah, I think we're somewhere around 18 million out of 21 million, something like that. But say 2 or 3 halvings from now, we'll be at 20.5 million out of 21 million, and then we'll float around 20.9 for a long
time. Let's go
time.
With your number. I think it's a little bit more than 18
it might
million.
Be. It might be.
So, but we could pretty much say it's still at least 10% left to be mined.
Sure.
But if this number, 29%, is lost or unmined, that must mean there's a 10% or more that's just lost.
So the lot, this is definitely something that should be talked about more because there's a huge amount of Bitcoin is lost, a huge amount. And effectively the way the market cap should be calculated is we're currently multiplying by the total number of Bitcoin which were ever brought into existence, but a lot of those are lost permanently, meaning that number is less, meaning for the market cap to be the same, if the market's willing to tolerate, you know, say 100 million, you know, 100 billion, 200 billion, whatever it is, the value should be higher than it is. Those lost Bitcoin just further limit supply and, you know, should be taken into account and should reflect the higher price.
I actually was contacted this week. I don't want to give too many details, and I don't even really know the identity for sure, but it was someone who was dealing with an estate of a miner, and they believe that there are 1,000 bitcoins in the miner's wallets. They're not sure because they don't have the expertise to be sure.
Yeah.
But that's what they think. And that's just one person.
Absolutely.
In this general area, geographic area.
Yeah.
And
it's very,
which is,
it's a,
by the way,
common,
if you're not doing
story,
the math, that's over $3 million.
Yeah, it's a very common story. There's a lot that have been lost, and that really influences, you know, the value of this.
So once we get it all mined and we're doing the transactions, because you're paying or you're trading, yeah, or you're doing something that is moving Bitcoin from one party to another party, then do the miners... I mean, there's going to be a marketplace where supply and demand happens, but we've seen it before when there's too much activity, the transaction costs, not the mining costs, just the transaction costs skyrocket. Could we get it at inflation in transaction costs?
It's possible, because what now, you know, I wouldn't directly compare it to, you know, times where the transaction fees have spiraled out of control, because that was basically due to congestion, that was due to the network not being able to handle the number of transactions, but there's really a point there, because once all the Bitcoin have been issued, or even most of them, you know, once the block reward is like 0.1 or 0.01, it's not significant anymore unless the price is really high, which, you know, is possible, but the miners start to live off transaction fees. The reward for mining switches from, you know, here's 12 Bitcoin, here's 6 Bitcoin, to you get the transaction fees. The idea is, now, this is like 20 years from now, you know, they're going to keep getting Bitcoin, at least in over a single Bitcoin, I think, for about 20 more years.
What are transaction fees amounting to?
Right now, not much. The goal is that in 20 years... Yeah, currently you pay cents to send a single transaction. You know, say there's a bunch of them, you're looking at a couple dollars. The idea is that maybe in a few years, you know, by that time where the Bitcoin stop being issued, the network will be so used, it'll be so global that the transaction fees will be able
is
to keep
there
it going.
Is there a difference in the, not the the cost for the person sending the Bitcoin or trading the Bitcoin, but for the miner, is there a difference in the cost of the materials consumed to do it between mining and transaction, or is that one and the same?
What exactly? Like, does the fee affect,
like,
how much resource they
can
use?
When I send a tenth of a Bitcoin to someone, there's a transaction fee. Is that also a mining fee?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, the transaction fees are mining fees. Those are fees being paid to miners.
So is the implication here, I get the feeling, is that when the limits have reached, the lost coins and all of the rest, and the condensed value down to, let's say, surprisingly 17 billion or whatever the numbers are, and the question is, where are the others? And then does that become something like gold?
Absolutely does, yes.
It's more rare than gold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even more fine.
It's not billions, it's millions.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, gold, we're still mining new gold all the time. We don't know how much gold there is. And if we ever get to mine in space, forget about it. It's full of gold. Space is full of gold.
So dump your gold.
That's that's the end of the gold.
Yes. Asteroid mining is the end of gold as a store of value. You heard it here first.
There is no space Bitcoin, though.
No, there you go.
Yeah, but Bitcoin is finite, unlike, you know.
So when that time approaches, which could be pretty soon.
That's what Jeff Bezos is going for. That's Blue Origin. They want to mine in space.
And they're going to do that pretty damn quick.
They're going to do that. Who knows when, but they're going to do it. Right. And it's a great idea. You take heavy industry off the planet, it's a really good win for Earth.
Well, the transfer.
Just litter the ozone with the broken down spacecraft.
Where they're working on the reusable ones.
There you go.
All right, let's move on to this next story. Speaking of another billionaire besides Jeff Bezos, Jack Dorsey, he's the CEO of Twitter and Square, is not just heralding adoption of Bitcoin, he is adopting it. The tech entrepreneur, 4.15 million Twitter followers of his now know that he owns a Trezor hardware wallet, and he used Bitcoin to make the purchase via the Square Cash app. at the current Bitcoin price, he paid approximately $261 for that. Well, in the course of that, he revealed that he is now buying $10,000 worth of Bitcoin each week through the, which is the cap on what you're allowed to buy. Of course, $10,000 is basically what you have to report to the IRS when transactions happen if you're following IRS rules. And you're, like, if you're in Coinbase, they report it and other places. Some places don't. Anyway, he's, of course, Jack Dorsey's going to do everything by the book with Square. And so he buys his maximum $10,000 each week through the Square Cash app. And then he got the hardware wallet because he needed somewhere to safely store his funds. Well, some people applaud that he's doing safe Bitcoining using a hardware wallet. Although it does beg the question is why
What's up with Square?
Yes. Why don't
you saying Square's not safe, Jack?
Yes. And now he has some other choices, the Trezor, over the hardware wallet ledger. His Twitter followers asked him about that, and it didn't take long for Ledger to tweet back about that, saying, "Hello, Jack, and thank you for raising awareness about Bitcoin. The security model of hardware is quite complex, and offering open-source firmware isn't a silver bullet." He had previously said that he picked Trezor because it was an open-source project. "We'll provide more flavor during the MIT Bitcoin Expo at mitbitcoinexpo.org on Sunday," which I guess was this past Sunday. And imagine, I must have been off the mailing list. MIT didn't let us know about their expo. Anyway, Dorsey is forecasting a massive acceleration for Bitcoin over the coming decade. And he's made it clear that sooner or later, the Square Cash app will integrate the Lightning Network technology, and that will accelerate Bitcoin transactions for everyday micro purchases. So some people have pointed out
that would be brilliant because you know, Cash App is I use Cash App a lot, and not just, you know, not just a Bitcoin thing, but Cash App is the best place to go to send very, very small amounts of money. You can send your friend $2, you know, you're at a store, they buy
what does
some
it cost you?
Nothing. It's free. It's and
is there a point it does cost?
No.
Square Cash App. We'll help you get it on your phone.
There's a, you know, if you want to have that money immediately available in your bank account or like next day, you pay, you know, a little bit. But if you're willing to wait a day, it's completely free. And so it's great for very small
amounts
of money.
If I want to send all you $100.
Yep, totally free as long as you wait a day.
$1,000 for free?
Waits a day. And there's a model behind that. They're using it to collect information and, you know, but the reason I'm saying this is so good is because Square is already something people use to send small amounts of money. It's just, it's a go-to for a lot of people.
Right.
And so then to bring Lightning Network there and to have it, you know, there's a, it's a similar thing. It's a similar application. It'll be a familiar place to people to go, and I think it'll be a really good onboarding point for Bitcoin Lightning Network.
Well, for most of us, buying $10,000 Bitcoin a week would sound like a pretty big investment.
Yeah.
But really, that's only, what, $500,000 a year? Am I right on that, Augie?
Yeah. Well, sounds about right.
$10,000 a week?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about $520,000. Yeah, $500,000.
So if you're a multi-billionaire,
yeah,
that's pretty good promotional money you just put in for getting people to.
That's a marginal thing.
On your app, and plus you get to keep it anyway, and you may make money. And
yeah.
But it still speaks to his confidence in this. And actually, you have the Square app, you said.
Yeah.
Do you do direct deposit?
Yeah, it goes straight to your bank account.
I mean, for a paycheck, do you do like a direct deposit or for any kind of reimbursement? Do you?
No, I don't use it for that.
Well, so if you have the Square app on your phone and you weren't so entrepreneurial and you still were getting a paycheck, you don't need a bank account anymore because Square can accept a direct deposit of a check from your employer. And they will also give you a Visa debit card connected to the Square app that you can make your payments just like everybody else. And so, really, you can go through the world now doing everything that a bank account pretty much does without a bank account.
That seems to be the undying desire that people have to circumvent banks and all the process involved in that. And I don't know. I'm a pretty conservative guy. I'm not ready to move. That's about collecting data about anyone and everyone, and, of course, this is another way to do that.
Yeah. The Square's business model, outside of a few ways they're able to make money, is they actually use all the information they collect to help. They have a small business loans company, and so they use the information on what people are buying to inform who they'll loan money to.
Right. If you're the merchant, say you had a little restaurant.
No, I get it. Go ahead.
Well, I know. And you have cash flow where you may, perhaps your bookkeeping is lacking and you want to go to your bank to get a loan, you may not be able to meet their requirements. But all Square wants to know is how much money is coming through our merchant services and what percentage of that are we going to take back every week?
Criteria is your income flow and what it really amounts to and their ability to give you the credit they're in and say, yeah, we'll make these loans for you.
So I don't know if that big a leap before car loans come through your Square app.
It's the same thing.
Or something like that.
All of that.
It definitely is possible.
Well, anyway, we talked about, Mr. Dorsey using the Trezor hardware wallet, and then Ledger hardware wallet tweeted not quite dismay, but making note of that. Well, and they said they're going to let people know about stuff at the MIT Bitcoin conference. It was this past Sunday. I don't know if this was released at the conference, but it did hit the news wires today. Major hardware wallet manufacturer Ledger, as in the one that was just tweeting to Jack Dorsey, has unveiled vulnerabilities in its direct competitor Trezor's device, according to a report published Monday. Studies state that the vulnerabilities were found by Attack Lab, the company's department that hacked into both its own and competitor's device to improve security. Ledger claims that it has repeatedly addressed Trezor about weaknesses in their Trezor 1 and Trezor T wallets and has decided to make them public after the responsible disclosure period ended. So, first issue is related to the genuineness of the device. And we'll go on to some other things here. I don't know if I can see Stevens looking to see what this. This was I put this in. This broke on the news right before I came to the studio. Secondly, Ledger hackers reportedly guessed the value of the PIN on a Trezor wallet using a side channel attack and reported it to Trezor in late November of 2018. So they've been sitting on this news for 5 months at least. The company later solved the issue in its firmware update 1.80. The third and fourth vulnerabilities, which Ledger also offers to solve by replacing the core component with a secure element check. Well, I could go on and
so
all.
So let's just make a note here. Just all of these sorts of attacks, you still need to have physical possession of the device. This isn't something, any of these attacks cannot be done. I can't just, go over the internet and hack your Trezor. I need to actually physically have your Trezor, and then I can hack it. And I'd be very surprised if that's not the case with Ledger. They're just not open source, so people can't dig through it as easily. But who knows, maybe they're more secure.
Well, that's an important point, though, because it also speaks to my, what some people would characterize as my inefficiency in security, or I might say just my laziness in security, is that I would rather have it in Coinbase or an insured exchange and rely on their credibility and their insurance to cover for me if anything were to happen, because just because you've got it in your hardware wallet doesn't mean you might not accidentally get it thrown out when you're cleaning out your sock drawer.
Yeah, I would argue if you had stored if you had some money in there, I think you'd be pretty careful not to throw it out. But I hear you, and there's a we could argue.
Well,
about
I still have silver dollars my uncle gave me back when I was 7, so I probably would hold on to it.
Yeah, and there's so much we could talk about different security things. Probably not. We don't want to get into that now, but that's I have a grain of suspicion. Definitely are taking with a grain of salt those comments about Trezor from their competitor.
Well,
not exactly
you know, there's some definitely some nuance to what they're
saying. Well, to actually get to blockchain topics other than involving cryptocurrency, much to the dismay of Charlie the Tuna at Starkist Tuna, North America's largest branded shelf-stable seafood, which is an interesting concept, shelf-stable seafood firm Bumblebee Foods has launched a blockchain platform for seafood traceability. The project was created in collaboration with German tech company SAP, specializing in enterprise software, according to a press release March 8th. By the way, the a trucking company in Florida about 2 months ago or 3 months ago made a lot of press on that one of their seafood transactions, as far as the shipping transaction, was tracked with blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be just coincidental, but maybe
that's
one of the first
automation.
One of the first markets where blockchain is in demand is in seafood, for whatever characteristics of that market is.
Start somewhere.
Well, anyway, based on the SAP Cloud Platform blockchain service, which I guess SAP is trying to steal some of IBM's thunder and some of these Microsoft, and everybody's getting on board. Anyway, this can purportedly monitor the supply chain of yellowfin tuna from Indonesia to end customers, which I don't know how many people that eat tuna sandwiches are even thinking about the fact that this has come from Indonesia. I know I haven't been.
I think about it every minute. I can't sleep.
Yes, well, if it's yellowfin, it's Indonesia. Anyway, I mean, don't we have tuna out in the Gulf? Don't we have it on this side of the planet?
Yeah, red tide tuna?
Yeah, well. Okay, maybe you make a point.
It's like yellowfin, but, you know, bacteria, algae.
Was made, this was at the, I guess everything's being announced at the South by Southwest Conference that's going on right now. You'll be able to observe the entire supply chain and access the product's origins, its shipping history, by using a smart device to scan the QR code. Include the size of the catch, the point of capture, as well as information about the authenticity, freshness, safety, etc. Recently, a French retail giant has started using blockchain to track milk, and Chinese Zhongqing Huizhong district, or rather the FDA administration of that district, is using it to track drug and quality assurance. So, we actually have movement on that case. There's another story we don't have time to get into, but if you think about those companies that we were just talking about, and the head of the consumer, the CFTC, Mr. Giancarlo, said blockchain could have prevented the financial crisis of 2008, it's no surprise that there is an explosion of job opportunities for blockchain developers, Stephen.
Absolutely.
And so you've taken advantage. You were an early pioneer in that space. So what are you saying?
Yeah, it is. I would say, you know, it's the view from kind of the front lines in that way. You know, there's a lot more going on than the prices might suggest. I've been surprised. You'd think with the prices how they are, like, you know, there might not be work or people, you know. And, you know, there was some slowdown, obviously, especially on the ICO front. But people are still, you know, there's lots of work. There's lots of people doing stuff. So it's a great place to be.
We are up against the clock, and we have a hard stop on this show for the show that follows us. But if you get back next week, what we need to explore is the nature of the blockchain developers, whether these new things are going with proof of stake, proof of work, some other kind of situation. Augie, thank you for being here. Thanks to Andy for being here. Thanks to Stephen for being here. And, in fact, I think we are so short on time now, we will have to let that break go, and we will be back next week. Oh.